It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The technology news website GeekWire has embedded reporters and editors in Pittsburgh for a month to tell Pittsburgh's stories. There is or was an FBI investigation into the city's relationship with a software contractor, and Pittsburgh is celebrating the official start of the Holy Lenten season. Those conversations are coming up, but first. It's been nearly 2 years since the Pennsylvania legislature passed and Governor Tom Wolf signed a bill legalizing medical marijuana, and this week, a handful of dispensaries began selling it. For patients with one of the 17 qualifying medical conditions, it's been a long time coming. We're going to talk about all this with Kate Malangowski, reporter for the Beaver County Times. Welcome to the program, Kate.
Thank you for having me.
Also in studio is WESA's health and science reporter, Sarah Bowden.
Hey, Kevin.
And on the phone, Post-Gazette reporter Steve Tweet. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you very much.
All right. The Commonwealth's first few dispensaries opened Thursday. Steve, Sarah, you went to two of them in western Pennsylvania. Where did you go and what was the atmosphere like? We'll start with you, Steve.
Yes, I happened to hit both dispensaries, the one in Butler, Cresco Yeltra, and then the Squirrel Hill facility. Quite a different feel in each place. The Butler dispensary had organized almost a reunion of some of the families that had been going to Harrisburg for the last 4 years to lobby legislators to pass this bill. The Squirrel Hill had a different feel. It was a little bit more open to the general public and saw all kinds of people with different medical conditions, some of which had tried various different medications. Some of them were self-medicating, but all of them were hoping to at least try medical marijuana to see if it'll help them.
And Sarah?
Yeah, I was also at the Squirrel Hill dispensary, and one of the conditions that you can get medical marijuana for is chronic pain. And it occurred to me as I was looking at this line of people that wrapped around the front of the building, a lot of them looked pretty uncomfortable standing there, using canes, leaning on loved ones. And when I talked to some of them, they were saying, yes, I'm here for pain, and you know, I've tried a lot of other things, or I was using opioids for a while, but I got addicted and I need to get off of that. And so a number of people are saying this is really my last option, and I really hope it works.
Kate, I know that you were at the Butler facility a little while back when they were doing a media preview. What was the situation? What was the environment there?
They definitely emphasized the fact that this is a medical facility. I think that the dosage and what you would need to use is going to be very regulated, and that was a big emphasis of the leaders there.
Okay. Now, some background here. As an industry, once Pennsylvania's medical marijuana sector is fully up and running, how many growers, processors, dispensaries will there be?
There'll be 10. Right now, only one is producing product, but there will be eventually 10 have been licensed.
Now, 29 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized it, but the laws vary from place to place. Some states allow the patient to grow it and smoke it. Others, you have to purchase it at a state-sanctioned facility. Some allow grass or even recreational use. Others, like Pennsylvania, only allot for oils, pills, or tinctures, which means no smoking.
You can vape it.
But vaping is different.
Oh, that's true.
Okay. So how does Pennsylvania's law compare to other places? Steve, it seems to be Pennsylvania's is somewhat more restrictive.
Well, it's almost like a regional characteristic. When the further west you go, the more liberal it seems to be. And the states in our area, Maryland, New Jersey, New York, tend to be much more regulated than the other states have been.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, any restrictions on how people can actually use the approved versions of the medical marijuana? Like, can they do something with the oils or not?
My understanding is that, you know, if you have an oil and somehow you're able to put that in your food some way, then I guess you can eat it. You can't sell edibles in Pennsylvania. And, you know, I'm not familiar with the oil enough to know that if it's something you actually want to cook with. But, you know, once you have it, it's yours.
So through this extended 22-month implementation process, I would like all your thoughts on what you've been hearing building up to this point from people who have been really waiting for this. Kate?
I think people really want relief. There was a man I spoke to this morning. He's waiting to be approved because he has fibromyalgia, but he hasn't been able to get an appointment with a doctor just yet in Beaver County because there are only four physicians approved by the Department of Health to prescribe medical marijuana. So he's actually looking to go to Pittsburgh. And there have been other family members who I've talked to who were granted medical marijuana use through Safe Harbor. You know, epilepsy is one of the 17 serious medical conditions approved for medical marijuana use. Mm-hmm. So I just think caregivers and people are looking for that relief.
Right. Steve, I know you spoke with a couple of mothers, I believe in Butler, who were among the first at that dispensary. Seemed like a very emotional exchange from what you were reporting on for the Post-Gazette.
Yes, and I mean, you mentioned that the law's been in on the books for about 2 years, but for these families, it goes back several years before that, where they have been trying to somehow get a bill passed so that they could continue using this medication with their children who has a intractable seizure disorder, and cannabis seems to be the only thing that seems to help. But, you know, I mean, I saw a pretty broad spectrum of reasons and motivations for people coming to the dispensary to seek products, you know, all the way from these families with these very compelling stories about their children to people who have been self-medicating for years and but have been continuing to use and get marijuana from places and from people they don't want to discuss. So in terms of a profile of the who is going to be seeking this out, I think it's going to take a while to shake out.
Yes, what Steve just said about people seeking out marijuana from different places to treat different conditions, that's something I heard too. I spoke to a gentleman who told me he was a veteran of the Vietnam War and was a Marine, and he says he's been using since, I think he said 1968, to deal with his PTSD. He says that certain smells, for example, can really put him in a bad place. He has a hard time sleeping through the night. So he's really excited to have a place where he can go and have an expert tell him the kinds of medical marijuana strains that he should be using.
Kate brought up an interesting point about the availability, the numbers of people who have been approved, the numbers of doctors. And according to the Wolf administration, although more than 700 physicians have either completed or are in the process of completing the necessary steps to certify patients, but about half of them have not been certified just yet. Plus, there are thousands of patients who have applied for a card who have not received their card yet, Steve. So how is this sort of backlogging? What are they doing? What's the state doing to free up some of this backlog?
Well, from all reports, Pennsylvania is doing better than some of its neighboring states did, but that doesn't mean it's the problem solved. I mean, the physicians obviously are a linchpin to this whole thing because you can't get your card for access to medical marijuana unless you have been certified by a physician. So if not enough physicians participate, then there's going to be a hold up there. And in other ways, I think, too, there are some sort of impediments to patients getting access, getting the card, and you know, making sure that they're able to logistically and as well as the cost of the medications be able to afford it. One risk with having a highly regulated industry like we have in Pennsylvania is that the overhead cost for growing, processing, and dispensing medical marijuana will force the groups to keep the price so high that some may resort to just continuing to buy on the street.
Oh, so let's get to that cost factor. Do we know yet how much it's going to cost? And will that be regulated by the state?
The numbers I hear pretty regularly is that people should expect to pay perhaps $200 or $300 a month. That will vary depending on how many products and what kind of products you buy. But for some people, that's going to put it out of range for them.
That sounds about right.
I know there have been studies that have been done as far as states that have legalized marijuana. Washington and Colorado specifically, opioid use has declined. So I think that, you know, it's obviously a very addictive substance. People are getting treated for that. So maybe we'll see some sort of savings, like, overall.
I spoke to a pharmacist at Solivo Wellness. He didn't want to be identified because he's worried that the work he's doing at the dispensary will affect his work at other places. But he said that exact thing. He said, I see people all the time with addiction, and he's very hopeful that this could be a solution.
Mm-hmm. Steve, who's allowed into these dispensaries? Is it just the patient or the caregiver or what?
Correct. You have to have a card, either be the patient or be the patient's caregiver in order to get in. Otherwise, you know, no friends, no family. It's very secure.
If the state is not going to regulate the cost, do we expect patients to sort of shop? And you know, they're not all that close together. Sarah?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And something interesting about permitting that's sort of related is that per dispensary, you can have three locations, but not in the same county. So depending on how spread out these dispensaries are, that could affect price. And then also, we only have 10 grower processors in the state, so it'd be interesting to see the range. We don't know yet, but right now prices are pretty fixed because there's only one grower processor that has product on market right now, but hopefully that will change soon.
What about health insurance? Steve, do we know, is health insurance plans, are they covering this?
Oh, no, heavens no. We're talking about a product that the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency says is illegal. In fact, it's listed as a Schedule I drug, which makes them a higher level of risk than even the opioids that we're dealing with now. And the reason for that is that they, at this point, are saying that marijuana has no medical use, which I think you could line up a whole lot of families who would disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. So the insurance companies don't want to tick off the feds?
No, they would not. They would not cover this.
Okay. So we have just a couple of minutes left. In the longer picture, will the Department of Health, Pennsylvania's Department of Health, will they be evaluating the implementation process, whether it's to reduce that backlog we talked about a little bit earlier, or whether more dispensaries or growers are needed? Is there an evaluation process, Sarah?
Well, the state is very proud of the fact that, you know, within 2 years of signing this law, there is dispensaries open selling medical marijuana. I wouldn't be surprised if more conditions were added to that list of 17, and then maybe in the future we might even see it legalized to sell the plant version or edibles.
One final question to all of you. What are you going to be following up on as you continue your reporting on medical marijuana, which dispensaries are slated to open next, others in Western Pennsylvania, et cetera? Let's start with you, Steve. What are you going to be following up on?
Well, I'm going to be very interested in ease of access for patients to the products. And also, from a business standpoint, are these dispensaries and grow process facilities, are they going to be able to make this a successful venture? I mean, they have to make money to stay in business. And, you know, they've had to lay out a lot of money, invest a lot of money just to get started. So, you know, if patient volumes aren't sufficient, they may run into trouble.
And, Kate, are you going to focus on the Beaver Butler area or the broader picture of medical marijuana?
Well, the thing with Beaver County is they do not currently have any proposed dispensary sites or grower sites. So I would definitely be looking into Butler and Allegheny counties and seeing how things are progressing. So I think my focus would be on residents of Beaver County. You know, are they getting their needs met?
Okay. And finally, Sarah Bowden.
Patients, you know, they don't know if this is going to work. They're very hopeful. So I'm going to follow up in the next couple weeks and months to see if their lives have improved.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Kate Malangowski is a reporter for the Beaver County Times. And Steve Tweet is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A Pittsburgh police officer filed suit this week claiming he was retaliated against for blowing the whistle on potential waste and wrongdoing at the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police. Jeff Benzing, public safety reporter for Public Source, has been covering this story for quite some time. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right, briefly, Jeff, who is Officer Chatterjee and what is he claiming regarding possible waste inside the Bureau of Police?
Right. So he's an officer that under the administration of Cameron McClay, former chief, was asked to look into technology projects used by the police bureau, basically see what's working and what isn't. And he claims that he found some pretty big problems, some things that were alarming to him, and reported to his superiors, including Chief McClay, and those findings or suspicions that were involved there helped touch off an investigation by the FBI.
Okay, so this involved business dealings between the Bureau, the city, and a contractor, B3 Solutions, and some expensive, critics might say outdated software provided by B3 that the city officers used to write up their official police reports. So what's wrong with the program? I believe it's APRS or other B3 products.
Sure. So what is stated in the lawsuit plainly, and also what we've heard from reporting that we've done over the past several months, the lawsuit is claiming that there were projects that were paid for that weren't finished. So the city paid in full for them, and they're not being used by the police bureau. The contractor, B3 Solutions, has said essentially that's Cameron McClay's fault. They finished everything they were asked to do, and the city didn't basically put them into use, and Cameron McClay frees those projects. So they blame him. And the sort of, I guess the reason why this matters is it means that there are officers being asked to do a ton of paperwork for things that, according to these projects, should be automated. So there's something called a daily activity report where they look, they track sort of the daily comings and goings of officers. And the union president told me just a couple days ago that the only thing he was aware of is officers were filling them out by hand.
But you're referring to union president Robert Schwartzwelder. I think he told you that when he was a patrolman, he wouldn't use the in-car version for the complex report, the complicated reports. Have others made similar complaints?
Well, so it's somewhat difficult to get police officers to talk on the record. We have what we have from the lawsuit, as well as some sources that we've talked to kind of all along the line. What we have, you know, in the story is the city's IMP department talks about, and that's innovation and performance, excuse me, talks about sort of the integrity of the what officers are able to do, you know, so things that take a lot of time to load on their computers, things that are not standardized. If you type in someone's address, Boulevard of the Allies is written 6 different ways. So sort of these things that are cumbersome and seem to have been put together, you know, sort of piecemeal. And that's kind of the, as far as the main APRS system, the complaint that's made, which is a little bit separate from the idea of if things were paid for and seemingly not finished, at least according to the lawsuit.
You also report that B3 has its defenders. Could it be that B3, what it offered, maybe wasn't the best, but was a lot better than what the department would be able to provide on its own?
Well, certainly what the city has said, and especially at the time when they were brought on and before Mayor Peduto came in, is that the city is not equipped to have software developers. The salaries aren't competitive. So you need to go to an outside contractor. And I think the questions that are raised here is if, you know, there is anything other than just complaints about systems. You know, you don't go to the FBI just because your computer doesn't work. And sort of what the heart of those concerns raised were if there were city staff who might have improper ties to B3, okay. And if things were paid for improperly. And it should be clear that the mayor's office said that that investigation closed without finding wrongdoing. The FBI basically won't say.
Okay, so there was an FBI investigation because there were federal funds involved in the purchase of the contracts of the software. Is that
correct? That's what was raised is if that's something that would have been a problem, the way that they were used.
Okay, so is Officer Chatterjee alleging more than just a poor choice of vendors, wasteful spending, something illegal here, or what is he alleging?
Well, so the idea that there would have been things that were paid for improperly, that's kind of at the heart of that. You know, right. If there were things that should not have been paid for, could have been paid for using federal grants, And that's something that we don't know the answer to it in terms of things that are on the public record now, other than he's making the allegation in the lawsuit that he found evidence that could point to that.
Very briefly, any response from Mayor Peduto on this?
Mayor Peduto says that there's an ongoing city investigation. What's interesting about that is Chatterjee in his lawsuit claims that the city's investigative body is actually looking into him, essentially for raising these issues. And he claims that that's something that was ordered by the person he names in the lawsuit, the deputy public safety director, who he also claims had ended a previous investigation into B3's relationship with the city and sort of distanced or eliminated some of the cooperation that the police bureau may have given to the FBI.
Okay, less than a minute left. The officer is also alleging more than wrongdoing on the part of his superiors.
Right. So he's alleging that he's been retaliated against. He says he was had a promotion blocked, that he's been the subject of racial epithets, racial stereotypes, and that this all stems because he tried to raise alarms about things that he thought were, looked suspicious. And when Chief McClay left, he says Chief McClay told us in a statement that the investigations were ongoing, and it seems that they have tapered off. And so he seems to have lost sort of a trusted ally when the chief left, and now seems to have faced some rebuke for that. At least that's what he's alleging.
All right. We'll look forward to your continued reporting on the story, Jeff. Jeff Benzing is public safety reporter for Public Source. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Kevin.
Coming up, the technology news website GeekWire has been stationed in Pittsburgh for a few weeks now. What have they found? What can they tell us about a certain Seattle-based retail company they already know very well? Stay with us. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Pittsburgh public schools teachers aren't striking, but they are one step closer. The union and district are negotiating Friday, but the union's executive committee authorized its president to call a strike if necessary. And seven Pittsburgh chefs and establishments were named semifinalists for the prestigious James Beard Awards. Lagoom in Oakland, Wiggle Whiskey, and the Ace Hotel's Whitfield restaurant all made the list. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh might not get to be the home of Amazon HQ2, but for the month of February, Pittsburgh is home to GeekWire HQ2. The American technology news website has embedded editors and reporters in Pittsburgh. We're going to find out why, what they're learning, and what should Pittsburgh learn from them with Taylor Soper and Nat Levy. They are reporters for GeekWire. Welcome to Pittsburgh. I know you've been here a little while, but welcome and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us. Great to be here.
Okay. If you have a question or comment, tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence.
People are getting this story about a steel town that has come back and re-identified itself. And there's a certain amount of hipness, almost, to the story of Pittsburgh.
So, gentlemen, is Mayor Peduto spot on, embellishing, or is he just being what he's supposed to be, the lead salesman for the city of Pittsburgh?
Peduto's, that's spot on. Pittsburgh is pretty cool, I gotta say, so far. We've been here for a little over 2 weeks, and Peduto's right. Pittsburgh's hip. Peduto himself is kind of hip, too, I would say, a little bit. He tries to be.
Okay. Nat, do you disagree or agree?
No, I'm with Taylor on this one. Pittsburgh seems like a pretty hip place to be. I like the soul that we have here.
That's we now.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess we've moved in.
Yep. Well, Taylor is basically a resident. He went grocery shopping the other day, so
I did
my
laundry.
He lives here now. Yeah. But I love seeing all the old buildings that have given second and third lives, and everything that has changed and become new again.
All right. So let's get to the obvious question. It was announced, I believe, in December, mid-December, that you were coming here. I think that's when the official announcement. Why? Why Pittsburgh?
Why the heck are we here?
Yeah, why are
Great
you
Great question.
So, as you may know, Amazon announced their U2 sweepstakes, if you will. And so we
Yeah, we heard that.
Yeah, you may have read or seen about that. But we sat down and said, why don't we do our own HQ2 and bring 1 to 3 jobs to a particular North American city?
It's a lot of economic development right there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we actually did our own RFP, and we had over 10 cities apply, and we did a whole process of, you know, which city should we go to do what we do in Seattle, which is cover the technology and the innovation and the impact that has on a city and its community. And so our finalists were Pittsburgh, Denver, Raleigh, and Cincinnati. And Pittsburgh, you won.
Okay. Now, your relationship, not necessarily you two guys, but GeekWire's relationship with Amazon. I mean, you're both in the same city, all right?
We need to make clear that we are not Amazon spies.
Oh, yeah, we've gotten that one a lot of times.
People here seem to think that we're investigating on behalf of Amazon. We are independent journalism news, not Amazon spies.
All right. So, but your relationship with Amazon seems to be fascination, maybe a little bit, suspicion, distaste. You phrase it whatever way you want. In one of the articles, you say, this is not just a love letter to Pittsburgh. It's a warning. So the visit to Pittsburgh, cautionary, explorative. We know you're not spying because you just said so.
All of the above. I mean, Amazon can do a lot of great things for your city and your community and your economy, and it can also have a bad impact depending on who you talk to. They've gone from 5,000 employees to over 50,000 just in that downtown core of Seattle, and that has a lot of impact. And so economic development, great, but be careful what you wish for, I think, is what we've learned in Seattle.
Yeah, it can really raise your national profile as a city. It can bring thousands and thousands of jobs. It can attract other companies that are interested in this very same people that they employ.
Well, but that sounds all positive. Where's the negative?
I'm getting to it.
All right.
But on the flip side of that, you know, population growth brings traffic. Seattle's traffic is just unbearable. Every time we go on a freeway here and it's not completely stopped, I'm stunned. Housing prices, They've risen dramatically in Seattle. It's the hottest housing market in the nation. Median home price is well above $700,000 now. Mm. So you're going to have a lot of side effects that come with that growth. And I would just say that it's important to think about those and plan ahead.
That's been one of the questions or concerns that's been raised ever since Pittsburgh applied to Amazon is, what about, we already have a lack of affordable housing. Now, you compare market to market, and Pittsburgh's housing overall is pretty affordable, but affordable depends on how much you make and what this will do, and will this drive prices up even higher for current residents. So that has been an issue. Have you heard that? Because you've been out in the public all the time, every day.
Yeah, we've attended these community Amazon HQ2 meetings here in Pittsburgh. Hearing this concern from citizens is what happens to, I've been living in Pittsburgh for 40 years and Amazon comes here. I don't want to be priced out. I don't want to be pushed out. And this is already happening, I think, in Pittsburgh. Even without Amazon, you've got Google coming here. You've got Uber coming here. So what happens to those local residents? Are they just supposed to leave because of technology growth? Or is the city supposed to, or companies, are they supposed to be thinking about this? Whose responsibility is that? So these are all questions that Pittsburgh needs to ask of itself, whether it's the mayor or the foundations or companies here. So we've seen a lot of what happened in Seattle, and so I think it's kind of cool being here and learning from Pittsburgh and also exchanging our own ideas with the city here.
So, Nat, you've been engaged, as we said, in a lot of public discourse. And I know at one of the gatherings, I believe it was a gathering of tech reporters, and our own Sarah Bowden was there. She was on earlier in the program. It was mentioned that maybe Pittsburgh's leaders don't have their eyes necessarily wide open when it comes to the whole Amazon issue.
Well, I'll defer to Taylor on that specific event because I wasn't there.
Okay.
But I think that there is a really big picture that you have to look at. When Amazon comes to town, your city changes dramatically. It might be for the better. It might be for the worse. It's hard to know until you see it. I don't think Seattle was ready for the kind of impact that Amazon had on the city. And I think that there are lessons to learn about planning ahead and understanding what you want Amazon to be within your community.
Amazon's RFP for HQ2 makes them sound like a very partnering, we want to partner with the city, we want to work with the community. That's not Amazon that we know in Seattle. And so maybe Amazon wants to shift how they do things with their community and their HQ2, but from what we've seen, Amazon in the RFP looks very different from Amazon that we know in Seattle. So it's a warning, and Mayor Peduto needs to be aware of this. And based on our conversation with him, I don't know that he is.
Yeah, I wonder if there is a reset coming with the way that Amazon relates to its communities. They did this process, this HQ2 process, so publicly. And it's interesting to see because, you know, it's very difficult to even get someone on the phone or talk to with Amazon. So if they're going through this new life as a more public company as they grow, HQ2 would be a great way to restart that if they're going to do it.
A lot of public discussion about avoiding the mistakes that were made as far as Amazon in Seattle. But has there even been discussion about how to avoid those mistakes, not just avoid those mistakes?
That's a good question. I think Amazon did not communicate, work with Seattle's political leaders. And so I think Seattle was a little bit blindsided when this HQ2 announcement came out. Some say that on behalf of Amazon, it was kind of a warning statement to Seattle's leaders, like, hey, we're here, we have this power. So I think Mayor Peduto is coming in with a good mindset to, you know, let's work with these companies. And he's learned from, you know, welcoming a company like Uber, and that hasn't gone super smoothly. But, you know, I think he's learned from that. And I don't know, we sat down with the mayor in his office, and we had a great conversation, but it was clear that he doesn't really understand what Amazon's all about, what they can do to a community. And they don't play nice, basically, with the Seattle community, the Seattle political leaders. But again, like Nat said, maybe that will change. So we will see. And I mean, I think Pittsburgh is a dark horse to land HQ2. I think it could happen.
Yeah. So, gentlemen, we have just about 3 minutes left. I'm going to ask you about diversity and tech. How much are you hearing of this? Are you doing any focused reporting on diversity and technology?
We are, and it's a big issue we've seen in Seattle, and we hosted a panel on Duolingo, one of the hottest startups here in town, and this was a topic that came up on the panel. It's something that people here are thinking about, which is important. Now, how do you actually keep Pittsburgh's diversity as tech comes in? That's a big question, and, you know, we don't have answers.
One of the most striking things that I heard this week was from the Duolingo CEO. He says that he does not want to go recruit at universities that don't have a large share of like female computer science students. And I think that's a good overall model to follow, that the companies are looking for more diverse workforces. And they're also saying to the universities, you have to do your job of recruiting diverse students so that we can do our job of recruiting diverse workers.
Okay, very quickly, where is Pittsburgh going in terms of technology? I know it's been a brief assessment on your part, but you've been immersing yourself. Wright Road, we need to open our eyes more. What's your sense, Nat?
Well, I think it's really interesting some of the trends that are coming out. I mean, I walked through a bunch of robotics companies just the other day, and to see where it's going, that seems to be the direction. I think that the city and its residents and the companies can always have more open discourse and more open relationships as neighborhoods like Lawrenceville and East Liberty really change a lot. I know that creates some tension and some nerves among the community, and the tech companies can come there and say, you know, we want to be a neighbor and a partner, and I think that might help.
In our 1 minute left, I want to ask you, what stories can we look forward to? You guys have published a bunch of fascinating stories, but what can we look forward to during the remainder of your stay?
Well, we've covered startups, tech, geeky stuff, but we're also just, you know, interested in what it's like to live in Pittsburgh. And we're going to Fish Fry tonight. And we're going to do some more arts and culture stuff and see, you know, what is it like to live here? Because that's an important question, right? If you're a tech company recruiting, is that city livable? Can you raise a family there? Is it cool for millennials? Is it hip? Apparently it is, according to Mayor Peduto. So these are all questions that we ask of ourselves and our readers are interested in as well.
And Nat?
Yeah, I think we're going to come in and continue to have fun and do some interesting stories and learn if this is the kind of place that can attract people from all around the globe, which is something that Amazon looks for.
Very good. Nat Levy and Taylor Soper are reporters for GeekWire. Check their reporting out. And they are embedded here, GeekWire reporters and editors, through February. Thanks so much, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, the season of Lent began Wednesday, a time of solemn traditions, but also some fun ones. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, a series of free organ recitals begins in Allegheny City, now the North Side, in 1890. They were performed at their Carnegie Music Hall, now the New Hazlett Theater, as part of a citywide trend of organ recitals. When Andrew Carnegie built his early libraries, many of them also included music halls with organs, an estimated 7,000 in total. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for February 16th, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Wednesday was the official start of the holy season of Lent. And you might have seen a bunch of people walking around with black smudges on their foreheads. Well, it was Ash Wednesday, of course, the start of the Lenten season. The season leading up to Easter Sunday, full of tradition from ashes to fish fries every Friday. Our guests now have reported on all of this. In studio is Peter Smith, religion editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Peter, welcome. Thank you so much.
Good to be here.
And also Ann Rogers. She's general manager of the Diocese Weekly newspaper, the Pittsburgh Catholic. Good to see you, Ann.
Great to be here.
And also joining us will be Rosalind Culgan, food and culture editor from The Incline. If you have a comment or question, please tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Okay. In Pittsburgh, Ash Wednesday usually brings out people of all faiths. You'll see the smudge of ashes on their foreheads, as I mentioned. And you were mentioning to me off air that people have stopped you in the streets to ask you about this?
Yes, on Ash Wednesday, I had a couple conversations like this where somebody said, excuse me, but, you know, do you mind if I ask what that thing is on your forehead? Everybody downtown seems to have one today. So, yeah, it was an opportunity to do a little evangelization and invite somebody back to the church.
All right. Now, are ashes strictly a Catholic thing or other Christian faiths?
They are a Western Christian tradition. Actually, they go back to Judaism, but in the Ash Wednesday context, they come down through the Catholic Church, and the Protestant traditions that are closest to the Catholics may also use them. So you find them with the Episcopalians, with the Lutherans, to a lesser extent with Methodists and Presbyterians, not so much among Baptists.
And Peter, are you out and about on an Ash Wednesday covering this? Or what about the whole Lenten season? What do you look forward to? What do you plan out in your coverage of events that happen during the Lenten season?
Well, it's the start of, you mentioned, a season, and the greater context is that it is 40 days minus Sunday toward Good Friday and Easter.
Right.
And so it really kind of begins kind of a series of ritual approaches to that date, which is kind of the apex of the liturgical year
right.
for Christians.
Now, Megan Harris, she's the producer of The Confluence, she told me that she saw a few restaurants, coffee shops, and some other spots posting online Wednesday with small bowls of cheater ashes on their counters. will they need penance for this? Really?
Possibly. it definitely doesn't count. The whole tradition is about repentance and fasting and prayer and coming back to God. And you cannot impose ashes on yourself. I don't think even a priest can do that. You need to go to the church in the Catholic tradition, into the church, into the sacred space to come before God in this gesture of humility and receive your ashes.
Oh. And what's different there is for the Protestant churches that have always done Ash Wednesday or that have taken up the practice in recent years, They don't have to do it in the church building.
Yeah.
They have a increasingly popular activity called Ashes to Go.
Yeah, okay.
So you could find a priest handing out ashes, handing out or imposing ashes in Market Square. There were some churches that got together in White Oak that were even doing Ash and Dash, where they would do drive-through ashes. You could actually pull up in your car in a church parking lot, get ashes on your forehead, and be on your way for busy people who couldn't. You couldn't have the time to actually go to a service.
So in your reporting, all Christians obviously observe Easter, but what about Lent and the degree observance? Does it vary from denomination to denomination?
Absolutely. The Eastern Orthodox are the most intense. It's a longer Lent. It begins on Clean Monday rather than Ash Wednesday. And they abstain from meat and cheese and fried foods and a whole list of things throughout Lent. I have Orthodox friends who tell me about like waiting outside the hamburger store for
okay.
Get their cheeseburger, yeah.
Okay. Now, today is the first Fish Fry Friday. I know other non-religious organizations and definitely restaurants like to take advantage of practicing Catholics abstaining from meat on Fridays in Lent. I'm curious, do we know how they started, Fish Fry Fridays? Do we know?
The tradition, for reasons that I won't go into that go back into the Middle Ages, fish and shellfish do not count as meat in the Catholic tradition. And so on these days of fasting, you could eat fish and not meat. So that was the tradition. It used to be every Friday, and it still kind of is for a lot of Catholics. In fact, truthfully, restaurants in Pittsburgh always have fish on the menu on Friday, most of them. So, you know, it just became, the fish fries just became a way to build community and do some fundraising around this.
Yeah, I want to get into that, but it is building community. Let's bring in Rosalind now as food editor of The Incline. You have to be all over fish fries, Rosalind.
We are very excited about fish fries. Even for folks who don't abstain from meat for religious reasons, the fish fry has really become a Pittsburgh tradition and even bigger than that. So we, for the second year, have launched our fish fry bracket.
This is like the NCAA tournament most of us are aware of.
It's a March Madness style bracket, but it has 32 different fish fries instead of basketball teams. And we have them divided up into fire halls, eateries, and then churches. Of course, we got the most nominations.
Oh, you're allowing restaurants to participate.
We are, because, you know, some of them do make some very special fish dishes for this time of year. But churches certainly got the most nominations. So we divided those up into an East category and a West category. We've got 32 now. Voting for the first round ends on Monday, so go out and try some fish fries and cast your vote.
All right. And the last year's winner was not allowed to be included, right?
That's right. That's St. Alphonsus. We wanted to give somebody else a chance. And St. Alphonsus has been wonderful sports about it. It's been really fun because there's even been a little fish fry trash talking, which is especially fun to come from churches, all good-hearted, of course. But St. Alphonsus told us, they actually wrote in their church newsletter, that they're the reigning champions, but they're saddened to learn that they can't participate. But they say their game is just so good that we're afraid that they'll win again. So they get it. They know it's time for another
NIT
chance.
This is the NIT of fish fries.
Yeah, it's very, very dramatic, yes.
Well, and Peter, will you be at Fish Fries either for reporting purposes or just for your own consumption?
It's very important to do research in these fish fries. It's very, very important.
And as a longtime journalist, we know that you adhere to that.
Absolutely, yes.
And what about you? Do you visit them?
I do when I can. There's actually one that's on my route home, St. Mary's in Cecil, that does baked salmon and crab cakes. And it's hard to convince myself that that's really fasting, but it's so good, and it supports the church and beats canned tuna.
I mean, it's hard work, but somebody has to do it, I guess, right?
What, make it or eat it?
Well, both, really, but I was referring to eating it. I am really excited to try out the Swissvale Volunteer Fire Department. They've been very active on Twitter telling us how awesome their fish fry is. So I'll definitely be checking that one out.
All right, Peter, you got to chime in here.
The range is pretty interesting. Some of them, it basically tastes like school cafeteria fish, and often that's because they make it in the school cafeteria. And others, you wonder why anyone ever gave Penance a bad name.
So, and you mentioned something that I want to follow up on, and that is it considered to be, you know, sharing food, sitting down and sharing food, how important is that into, you know, outreach to be with people?
Oh, I mean, absolutely, it's part of outreach. And really, I mean, it's kind of at the heart of church community when you consider that the Eucharist is sharing a meal. So absolutely, bringing people together, having conversations, you know, in the context of the church. And, you know, obviously it's not all on spiritual topics, but it does allow people to raise questions about, you know, why are you doing this? What's that weird thing on your forehead? And, you know, it's a wonderful opportunity.
A way to connect with people, right? You know, you were all mentioning and pointing out ones that you want to try or have tried. I will point out, full disclosure, the bishop came to my parish's fish fry last year and brought the whole seminary class. So so take that. So,
what parish is that?
It is St. Catherine of Sweden. And I fry the fish there. So there.
Wow.
So anyway.
Excellent.
Does the bishop, you know, is that part of his, you know, pastoral approach, you know, going to a lot of these?
And, well, and part of his, you know? I think he usually goes to, like, lead the Stations of the Cross or some type of Lenten devotions. But, yes, he usually visits the fish fry.
But it's a chance for him to connect as well.
Absolutely. Well, he visits parishes all the time. But it might be a particularly deep and enjoyable experience during Lent.
Okay. And Rosalind, I want to quickly mention, we're just running out of time. You also have a fish fry map. Is that it?
Yes. You can check that out on our website, theincline.com. It's on our homepage today. So make a road trip of it and check out some fish fries.
All right. Peter and Ann, what are the other things that we can look forward to in your reporting over the next 5-6 weeks of Lent? What stories are you working on developing, Peter?
We're coming up on the 5-year anniversary of Pope Francis being elected, so we're working on that. And obviously, later this year, the bishop will be announcing the reorganization of Catholic parishes, which will be pretty significant as well.
Right. And Ann?
Well, specifically in relation to Lent, we have The Light is On for You on March 21st, when every parish in the diocese will be open for confession from 6 to 9 p.m. And we have a whole outreach campaign around that. We do bus shelter ads and radio ads and really encourage people who've been away from confession for a long time to come back.
All right, so we have just about 30 seconds left. And sometimes that reconnection can happen through, Rosalind, fish fries.
Absolutely.
Of course.
All right. And Ann, we know at least one fish fry that you'll be attending to.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So thank you so very much for coming in. Ann Rogers is the general manager of the Pittsburgh Catholic, the weekly newspaper of the Diocese of Pittsburgh. Peter Smith is religion editor for the Post-Gazette. And Rosalind Colgan is the food and culture editor for The Incline. Thank you so much for all being here.
Thank you for having us.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for our program is Tom Hurley. Research and production assistance from Zakiya Madjan. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.